This is Greater LA, KCRW's show that connects you to the people and places of Southern California. I'm Steve Chiotakis. Today, we're in Skid Row, and it's hot, miserably hot. You know that heat wave we had? It was particularly harsh for people who live on the streets. Well, here on Skid Row, there are more than 4,000 unhoused residents. And for all those folks, there are five, that is right, five drinking fountains, plus a few hydrating stations where you can fill up a water bottle. One woman, who gives her name as Kyoto, lives here and explains how she usually gets water.
Pretty much it's like some people from the sprinklers, some people from the fire hydrants, but it's really hard. I usually get water when I get a chance to use the restroom, and that's not very often.
On this day, though, Kyoto is in luck. Someone hands her a gallon of water.
Hello, how are you today?
That someone is with Water Drop LA, a new mutual aid group that hands out water here every Sunday during this heat. They say they're stepping up where the city is not.
I mean, ideally, nobody in the city would have to fight for another person's human rights, especially in a place like Los Angeles that is often viewed as one of the most liberal and progressive cities in the U.S. But that being said, if no one else is going to do it, we will.
That's Aria Catano, a co-founder of Water Drop LA and a full-time college student over at USC. KCRW's Angel Carreras joined Aria and the rest of the group to see them in action.
Before they get to Skid Row, about 50 volunteers meet in a church parking lot down the street from USC. They unload more than 1,000 gallon-sized plastic jugs of water from a big U-Haul and pack them into the back seats of their cars.
Anyone else want to jump up here?
They get their water wholesale from Restaurant Depot, by the way, paid for by donations. Everybody here has a film of sweat on their brows, their shirts stuck to their clammy skin. But they're wearing smiles, too.
Yeah, it's so much easier.
Most are USC students. Some are volunteers who heard about the group through social media.
So just some really quick tips that we're going to go over. When you're giving out water, make sure you call out the fact that you're handing out water and also hold it up so that people can see in case they don't hear you. One thing we're really strict about, if you haven't been with us, is please don't take photos of people's faces.
Before heading out, the volunteers circle up for the ground rules in regards to communication.
Or something that we could use for like good PR. And there's no room for saviorism here. That's something we will reiterate over and over. So yeah, if anyone has...
After the debrief, they head to Skid Row. They're going to try to cover as much of the neighborhood's 55 blocks as they can.
We're called Water Drop. We do water drops every week.
People on the street walk up, bike up, and take a gallon.
Well, take care. It's really hot out here, huh?
It's very hot.
Hello, how are you today?
Yep.
Thank you.
Take care.
Thank you.
Yep. Need some water? You good?
Sometimes volunteers do a knocking at the homes of the unhoused.
Anyone home? Do you want some water?
Yeah, to get fresh, like, water, like, what we have here, very, very difficult.
This is a man named Fly. He invites me into his tent. It protects him from the sun, but man, there's definitely no air flowing through here at all. It's like a mini sauna inside. Fly has a Mountain Dew and a Powerade in his tent. I ask if it's hard to come by water to cool off.
Very hard. Yeah, very hard. Because I went by Midnight Mission, and they stopped people from using their water fountain for whatever reason, so.
Water Drop LA is just a little over a month old. In that time, they've grown fast financially. Donations have snowballed from a few bucks from Facebook friends here and there to over $100,000 from people as far as New York. And they're growing in volunteers, too. From a handful of people the first few times to 50 volunteers a week, which is where they cap it off at. Here's co-founder Aria Catano again.
I think one of the main things that keeps people coming back is that once they go the first time, they really see how large the need is. They see the lack of water fountains. They see how desperate at times people can be for water. And I think it really just, you know, you can read about these things, but once you see it in person, it becomes personal.
Water Drop LA's founders, just two USC students in their early 20s, devote not just Sundays, but basically their entire lives at the moment to this endeavor. That means social media, infrastructure, meeting and teaming with other organizations to help Skid Row residents, getting the water, all that jazz, it's all them. They say they've spent as much as a combined 100 hours a week doing this. Co-founder Katie Cummings even took a break from school this semester to devote more time to Water Drop LA. Here's Katie on how long she thinks they can keep this up.
We've been talking a lot about how obviously this is something that is a temporary solution. Just by like factually, we're giving someone 1 gallon of water. That's not like installing a sink or a water fountain. So ideally, like we would get to a point where the city of LA installs a water fountain on every corner and there's no need for us.
And well, why are college students doing this? Why not the city? What are they doing about this?
It's not just like, here's a street, here's a water fountain, let's put it in.
That's activist turned city official Kirkpatrick Tyler. He's the director of Skid Row Strategy for the mayor's office. He's partly responsible for the 5 permanent water fountains Skid Row does have. Tyler says he wants more fountains, but the process to do so is a long road. Talks with stakeholders, businesses, city council, getting funding, passing that through motions, that kind of stuff. And on top of that, the water has to be paid for by someone. Because of that, figuring out where to put fountains is more involved than you might think.
So the parks were easy because Parks and Recs absorbs that water cost. When we put them on public right-of-way, there still has to be a water line that it's connected to. There still has to be a group that absorbs that cost. And so a part of the work of placement was those was figuring out who's going to absorb the cost for the water fountain, right?
Now, I'm told 2 more permanent water fountains are in the works, which would bring the total number of drinking water sources in Skid Row to about 1 for every 671 people.
It's not enough. Right? So this isn't like, oh, look at us, look what we did. This is to say that we see the problem, we had some resources and we're allocating those, and that this is the planting of a seed into the work that is still to be done.
Need some water? You good?
Water Drop LA continues to hand out water every Sunday. As their volunteer network and donations grow, they look to as well. They're looking into becoming an official 501c3 nonprofit, and they're hoping to reach more areas of LA.
Guys,
Venice, Santa Monica, Echo Park,
man.
Orange
Thank
County.
You. Thank you for doing God's work. You already know.
Anywhere they can help fulfill the unhoused community's need for fresh water. For KCRW, I'm Angel Carreras.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
All right, moving on now with Greater LA on KCRW. Today is the last day of a COVID-shortened session of the California legislature. All remaining bills have to be voted on by tonight if they're going to reach Governor Gavin Newsom's desk. Now, the session started back in May while the protests over the killing of George Floyd were filling streets all across the state and country. And a big focus of legislative work in Sacramento has been police reform. But even though lawmakers introduced nearly 24 bills during the session to address such reforms, LA Times Capitol Bureau reporter Anita Shabria says only a handful of those bills are still in play. And she's with us right now from Sacramento. Anita, hello.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
You bet. One of the bills that's been getting a lot of attention is Senate Bill 731. This is State Senator Stephen Bradford from Inglewood, the author of the bill. What does it do?
Well, Senator Bradford's bill would really bring us in line with what most states already have in place, which is a system for taking badges away from officers with records of misconduct. So right now in California, we don't really have a centralized system for tracking problem officers. They can go from one agency to another, whatever the circumstances are of that leaving. And this bill would create a state mechanism for taking badges away from officers if they've engaged in serious misconduct.
So this is sort of a decertification, right? If you mess up, you're unable to wear that badge again, right?
Exactly. Right now, we don't have a state certification for officers necessarily that can then be taken away. So this just establishes that state standard of what it means to be an officer and puts a mechanism in place for decertifying if something goes wrong.
There's also a qualified immunity aspect to this bill as well, right? A provision that would make it easier for officers to be sued in a civil court, right?
That is absolutely correct. So often, unfortunately, fatal uses of force end up in civil court where people are trying to seek justice when criminal charges aren't filed. But officers largely are immune to any kind of financial responsibility. This seeks to give them some of that financial responsibility if they are sued and do lose.
The LA Times, Anita, has editorialized in support of the bill. The ACLU actually helped write it. But it's facing some strong opposition from police unions. What do they have against it? I can imagine the reasons, but go ahead.
At the baseline, most police unions and police officers in the state do agree that we should have some method for getting bad cops out of the profession. I do think there's a genuine desire on the part of police to clean their ranks of anyone that they feel doesn't meet their standards. But where they really, really object to this bill is on a couple different levels. The most strident objection being that it includes a very strong civilian oversight panel that would have the ability to make a recommendation about decertification then that could be overturned by the state agency, but really does carry a significant amount of weight. The police are very concerned about that panel because it specifically includes families of victims of police violence and advocates for police reform. And they feel that that makes it biased against them. Police are also concerned that the way the bill is written might conflict with existing labor laws and contracts that from individual states, the labor union contracts from individual agencies. So they have objections on a couple levels.
So the police union is worried about the power of reform advocates. They're worried about the power of families of victims of police violence. I wonder, though, the police union is very strong. How strong is it in Sacramento as far as a lobbying group goes?
Incredibly powerful. It's been an interesting couple of years for police unions, though. Last year, we had an bill, Assembly Bill 392, that changed when officers in California can use deadly force. That was really a turning point and an eye-opener for police unions, because for decades, they have been a very strong power at the Capitol. But faced with protests over Stephon Clark, who was an unarmed Black man who was shot by Sacramento police, they really had their power shaken at the state Capitol. But you're seeing this year kind of them getting their footing back under them, where we started off the year with the George Floyd protests. That's faded as wildfires and other crises have overtaken us. And so there's less momentum this year at the Capitol for change. And that's allowed some of the unions to get their feet back under them and regain some of that power that was shaken last year.
The session ends tonight. Police unions, Anita, have actually asked the governor to convene a special session just to deal with police reform. Does it look like there's any chance of that happening?
No, the governor made it clear the day they made that request that he really has no interest in that. And it really set off a couple days of intense lobbying on both sides when it became clear that this is the make it or break it time for these bills. So we have seen, you know, 4 or 5 days now of just intense pressure on both the side of the unions and the side of the activists to determine the fate of these bills.
I want to talk about, because at the outset we talked about dozens of bills introduced weeks ago that have now been pared down to just a handful. What is the strongest bill that you see as far as police reform goes that is still there that could make it through tonight?
I think there's two, actually. I think the Bradford bill on decertification is by far the most controversial and far-reaching, and I don't think we'll have an answer on that bill until very late tonight. And I think that there is another bill by Nancy Skinner out of Berkeley that would once again expand what personnel records we have access to when there is some kind of misconduct on the part of an officer. And that would provide us with even more insight into how investigations are done and where problem officers are. So I think those two bills are really the big ones that we're watching today.
There's obviously so much going on this last day of the legislative session in Sacramento. I want to thank you, Anita Chabria, who covers state politics for the LA Times in the state capitol. Anita, thanks.
Thank you.
Onward now with Greater LA on KCRW. I'm Steve Chiatakis. Over the past week, we've been remembering the Chicano moratorium protest of August 1970. On the 29th of that month in that year, tens of thousands of people took to the streets in East LA to protest the Vietnam War. One of the reporters covering the march was LA Times journalist Ruben Salazar. But something terrible happened while it was going on. An L.A. County sheriff's deputy fired a tear gas canister that hit Salazar in the head while he was sitting inside the Silver Dollar Cafe. It killed him. Well, we remember Salazar as one of the first mainstream media reporters to cover Southern California's burgeoning Mexican-American community. And he did so with national and historical context. L.A. Times columnist Gustavo Arellano knows a lot about Salazar's work, born after his death, but someone who studied the things that he wrote over the years, and Gustavo's with us right now. Hey.
Hola, Steve.
Now, Salazar's writing focused on L.A. At least as a columnist, he focused a lot on East L.A. and Pico Rivera and other places. He reported on much of Southern California. He actually lived, though, in Santa Ana. Tell us about his Orange County connections.
Yeah, so people make Salazar, and rightfully so, I would say, to be this martyr of the Chicano movement. But in the process, they make him out to be like this radical Aslanista, always, you know, Mexican, Mexican, Mexican. But the reality is Salazar lived in a nice part of Santa Ana in a, you know, two-story home, married a white woman. You know, he was a bon vivant. He loved his French food. He loved his French wines. He loved holding cocktail parties where he liked to challenge people on their arguments by sort of always taking the devil's advocate. So this is a man who can't just be limited by what he covered. He was so much more than that.
Well, I want to play a clip because you said bon vivant, but he had some pretty strong opinions about the Mexican-American population and particularly here in Southern California. This is a clip from a show called The Siesta Is Over, which aired on Channel 2 way back in the day, back in the early 1970s. And here is Ruben Salazar just a couple of months before he died. Let's listen.
I hear so much the theory that that the Mexican-Americans will eventually evolve in the way that the Irish or the Germans or other immigrants evolved and will become Americans. I don't agree with that, simply because the Mexican-American or the Chicano is not an immigrant to this part of the country. We've always been here. And so it's foolish to think that eventually we will melt into that mythical melting pot. We never will. We were here first, and we're just not going to melt.
We're not just going to melt. So you say, you know, I mean, you say he lived in the nice part of Santa Ana, two-story house, all of that stuff, but he was advocating, saying, hey, look, we were here first. We're indigenous to this region.
You want to talk about a great what if in journalism? It is Salazar, because people remember him only as a columnist, but he was only a columnist for the last 7 months of his life, from February 1970 to his final column, which was filed the day before he got killed. Before that, he was a reporter. Before that, and you read some of his earlier stuff, there's a great anthology of his work called Border Correspondent, edited by UC Santa Barbara Chicano Studies professor Mario T. Garcia. And his older stuff is very mainstream, very middle of the road, even in some cases a little bit conservative and skeptical of the Chicano movement, skeptical of people who are saying that the American way has not treated Mexican Americans properly. But you hear that clip and you start reading his later stuff, and yeah, a revolution is happening in his mind, even if on his private life he's still very resolutely middle class. I mean, late 60s and early 70s, you know, the fashion was starting to loosen even for reporters, but Ruben was always wearing his shine black shoes, his sports coat, his tie, his white shirt, press slacks. Very, very professional.
You wrote an essay for the LA Times. You're a columnist for the LA Times now. By the way, congratulations to you on that.
Thank you.
And it starts with you reading Salazar's work as a young college student, years after he died. What were your impressions of what he was writing?
Every Chicano studies, even if you're not a Chicano studies major, if you're a Mexican-American who's slowly starting to radicalize, you know, you realize sort of the history against your people that California has hoisted on you for over 170 years, you eventually get to that. So I bought that book thinking, oh, wow, I'm going to read a whole bunch of radical stuff. And no, like I said earlier, a lot of it's middle of the road. A lot of it's very mainstream. Salazar was not the greatest of writers. Even his friends will say that. But I was missing the point. And so in my LA Times essay, part of a huge huge package that we did on the Chicano moratorium, which were the anti-war protests where Ruben Salazar got killed. My part of it was coming to a reckoning with it, which was that Salazar, yeah, he wasn't the greatest of writers, but as a reporter, he was no less than a John the Baptist, really doing now what we think is a cliche, which is the Mexican-American, the Latino beat, but doing it by himself with no roadmap and yet doing stories that 55 years later still resonate. The issues he was talking about then, gentrification, police brutality, all of that stuff, we're still talking about it to this day.
He was a reporter at the LA Times when you could count the number of Latinos there on one hand, right? Like there weren't a whole lot of folks who were not only not covering the beat, but there weren't a lot of Latinos at the newspaper in the first place, right? How did he create that Mexican-American beat?
As far as we could tell, he was one of four Latino reporters when he joined when he came back from an assignment in Mexico City in 1969. And there was only two black reporters at the LA Times, just to show you the environment that he was working on. I talked to a contemporary of his, Bill Drummond, who was a second ever black reporter hired by the LA Times. And he would say how during news meetings, you know, editorial meetings, white reporters would put on fake Mexican accents in front of Ruben and, you know, basically mock the very people that he was reporting on. And Ruben, ever the professional, didn't say anything and just proved the worth of Mexican-Americans through his writing. And what he did was, what's amazing about him is that he just followed the story. In many ways, what Ruben did wasn't very remarkable, but the fact that he was the first one who did it and did it really years before anyone else even bothered to just shows again what a visionary he was.
Gustavo Arellano, columnist for the LA Times with this week's Orange County Line. Gustavo, as always, thank you.
Gracias.
All right, before we leave you today, let's do the weather. Here comes the sun. Oh, no rainy nights. Gosh, for another couple of months, I'm sure. But in the meantime, it's going to start getting really hot. We've had a bit of a reprieve from the hot weather lately. Temperatures in the low 70s. Today's been really nice, especially at night, where temperatures have been rebounding a little bit back into the upper 50s, low 60s. But relish in that for the next few days before we get into this weekend, because temperatures are going to start creeping up toward week's end. 70s, 80s today through Wednesday, and then increasing after that, 5 to 10 degrees every day as we get into Thursday and Friday. And this weekend, a real heat wave sets in Southern California. We're talking about high pressure that's fixated over the Southwest, Nevada, Arizona, and California, affecting our weather, keeping things still and hot with an offshore flow this weekend, 90s and 100s. Record-breaking heat possible. Could see some problems with heat or sunstroke. Could see some problems with the power grid again and the demand for air conditioning. So you're likely to hear that in the coming days with this latest heat wave coming later in the week. Sunday will be the hottest day on Sunday. So bear in mind, we're talking about 100 all the way to the coast, perhaps 100 to 105 in downtown LA, Pasadena, 110 in the valleys, 115 to 120 in Palm Springs. Thinking about a long Labor Day break over in Palm Springs? Boy, I hope you have a pool handy because it's going to be really hot there. And 120 to 125 in Death Valley. Record-breaking heat, less hot next week, but it will take a while to get through the heat wave that will start again later this week. Take some precautions now. Know that there will be some cooling centers opened in the city of LA and the county of LA as well. You can find one closest to you at ready.lacounty.gov/heat. And that's going to do it for us today. Tomorrow, a San Fernando Valley dog park brings Angelino and Pooch together. We're online at kcrw.com/greaterLA. Share what you're thinking with us and subscribe to the podcast as well. kcrw.com/greaterLA. Jenna Cagle, Catherine Barnes, Sonia Geis, Amy Ta, Paul Smith, Phil Richards, Ray Guarna, Mario Saavedra, Sue Margulies, and Christian Bordahl all had hands and ears on this show. Thanks for your ears this evening. I'm Steve Chiatakis. Have a great night.